From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today was a national day of mourning in Sri Lanka. There's still a state of emergency in effect, and the island nation held its first mass funeral for the victims of the Easter attacks as ISIS claimed responsibility for the bombings at churches and hotels that killed more than 300 people. Local police had said the attackers were a local group, and there's been outrage that Sri Lankan security forces acknowledged they were warned earlier this month that that group might attack. BBC security correspondent Gordon Carrera is watching all of this. And Gordon, we know the U.S. had claimed defeat of ISIS in Syria. Now this claim from ISIS of attacks in Sri Lanka. Is it credible?
I think it is credible, yes. We've just seen some more information, which includes a picture of some of the alleged attackers that ISIS has put out through their official news agency and identifying which targets they may have struck. And that comes after an initial statement simply saying it was their fighters, but with no more evidence. But I do think this would help explain a crucial question, which was how what looks like a local group was able to carry out one of the most deadly terrorist attacks we've seen in recent years. And I think there was always this question about a group which had previously been known for vandalising Buddhist shrines, how that group could suddenly transform itself, both in terms of who it was willing to target and on what scale. And I think some role for ISIS would help explain that.
Yeah, well, and we were wondering, and again, it's just speculation, but maybe the ISIS strategy was to occupy a lot of resources in Iraq and Syria, fighting them there, you know, drawing the Kurds and others in Syria, the U.S., fighting them there, while they did set up operations in other places like Sri Lanka.
I think there's certainly a case that the ISIS ideology persists beyond the end of the physical caliphate that they ran in Iraq and Syria. And I think it's also the case that at the moment, they're very keen to show that they are still around. And so I think, in a sense, they're very keen to try and carry out attacks. And there have been some others in other countries and some in some quite surprising places in Africa as well, where we've not seen activity. And it is almost as if ISIS is trying to say, you may have driven us out of what we thought was going to be our caliphate, but we are still around for the long term. And that's an important message from their point of view, for their supporters as well, because they want to keep their level of support up and not look like they are a defeated organization.
Well, and what about the thinking that the Sri Lankan attacks might have been retaliation for the attack on the mosques in New Zealand?
It's possible. I think there is some skepticism about it, partly because this kind of attack, the sophisticated attack we've seen in Sri Lanka, would have taken a lot of planning to get hold of so many detonators. And there appears to have been intelligence warning about some kind of preparation 2 weeks ago. So if you count that back from then the Christchurch attack, which was just over a month ago, it seems hard to think that it all started and came together in that short period. It's not impossible, but there's a bit of skepticism about that possibility. Mm.
Well, and speak about those warnings that came to local police. They were said to have come from the national, I believe it's Tawfiq Jamaat.
Yes, that's the group that they were concerned about, that they believe that that's the group. And what's amazing is that these police reports, which appear to be based on intelligence from a foreign country, suggested that this national Tawfiq Jamaat was planning some kind of attack, perhaps on churches. And the detail of their intelligence report is remarkable because it includes names. It indicates there was some kind of surveillance.
Well, the people have been arrested.
Exactly. And it really raises questions about why wasn't more done to either protect the locations or to go after the suspects. Now, when Sri Lankan officials have been asked about that, they've said, well, we didn't expect anything like this. And of course, no one did. And this attack really is completely out of any kind of expectation levels for the kind of violence we've seen in Sri Lanka or from that group. But still, given that kind of specific intelligence, it is really going to be a serious problem for the Sri Lankan authorities to answer questions about intelligence failure when they had that kind of intelligence and do not appear to have acted on it.
Well, and to be clear, again, the National Tawfiq Jamaat,
yep,
if the warnings came about them and some members have been arrested, is that ISIS kind of throwing them up as a front? Were they coordinated?
It is too early to be sure. I think the question is this a local group which had been around for some while and had been involved in communal tension between the Muslim and the Buddhist communities in Sri Lanka? And then was there some kind of contact with ISIS, which transformed it and shifted it. But what I think is noticeable is you take this group, National Tawhid Jamaat, which previously had been focusing on the Buddhist community and attacking shrines, and suddenly it's attacking Christians and attacking tourists. Both of those are classic ISIS targets. So something looks like it happened to this local group, which made it much more in line with the ISIS ideology. Now, what that is and quite where that connection took place, that we don't know yet.
That's BBC security correspondent Gordon Carrera in London. Gordon, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we've been reporting on the problem of what happens to all the plastic we throw away in this country. It used to go to China for recycling, but they banned plastic imports last year. So now much of it goes to other countries in Southeast Asia instead. Problem is, according to a new report out today, those other countries can't handle all that waste. As part of our series, Going to Waste, we're joined now by Bo Bekongas, the regional plastics campaigner for the Global Alliance for Incinerator Alternatives, which published that report. She's on Skype from the Philippines. Bo, welcome.
Yes, thank you.
Well, which countries are getting this waste and how much are they getting?
Well, based on our research, we looked at three of the biggest countries that are receiving waste. This is Indonesia, Thailand, and Malaysia.
And how much are they getting?
Based on our research, Thailand was getting a more than 1,000% increase. So that's pretty huge. And that happened right after the ban that China imposed on imports.
And what are they doing with all of this plastic waste?
Well, they're trying to sift through all these plastic waste. It's basically mixed waste, and then they're trying to get whatever they are able to recycle from the waste. Sometimes they find money. In our report, we saw people, they would see dollars and euros. And of course, they are able to get a few things, like maybe copper from all the cables that they get included in the shipment. There are a few, like hard plastics, maybe a few plastics that they can recycle. But in general, a very small amount is really recyclable. The rest, they send it to the cement factories, cement kilns, to be used as fuel.
To be used as fuel, so then the fumes end up in the atmosphere.
That's right. So all the pollution is ending up in the environment. So it's in the air, in the soil, in the water. And in the report that we put out today, you can see stories of how people were suffering. Like there were reports of miscarriages. There was one farmer who said he had to buy water for his cows so that they could drink water because he could not give them water from his land because they were polluted.
And have these countries in Southeast Asia tried to push back or regulate what's coming in?
Yes. A few months after that happened, when China closed its doors to waste imports, Malaysia and Thailand tried to put in some restrictions. So they will be banning some imports of waste starting 2021, I believe.
So it's only a matter of time then before these countries, it sounds like, follow the lead of China and say no more.
Yes, yes. Right now, the bigger, more waste is going to Indonesia because Indonesia is way more lax and way more open to receiving the waste.
Now, if the waste is just sitting there in landfills in these countries, the concern around the world is that it will end up in the ocean. And a study in the journal Environmental Science and Technology estimates that up to 95% of plastic pollution in oceans is coming from Asia and Africa. Why does so much of it end up into the ocean?
Well, plastic is very light. It's easy to be carried by the wind. And also, sometimes they get carried into waters and streams and rivers so that they drain into the oceans. So there's no regulation or any kind of measure to keep them in closed facilities at this time because a lot of these imports are being dumped openly in open fields and farmlands that have been converted into dump sites.
So what do you think is the solution to this? Obviously, the world is going to continue to produce a lot of waste and a lot of plastic waste right now. What can be done?
Well, primarily, we would like to see reduction in the production of plastics. There is no other way that we can reduce, because we've seen that recycling isn't enough. Globally, we are only able to recycle 9%, according to the statistics. Unless we change the way we look at how recycling as a solution, we will never see the reduction in this kind of waste and the problem that it will cause to our oceans and to the environment in general. So we believe that we really have to cut down on the production, the consumption, and the disposal of plastics.
That is Bo Bakongas, who is the regional plastics campaigner for the Global Alliance for Incinerator Alternatives. We'll link you to their report out today at hereandnow.org. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Do you know the name Uba Butler? If not, he might be shattered. He's made a name for himself, making a name for himself. When he was a teenager, he made calls pretending to be Martin Davey, rock band manager extraordinaire. That was to get his band booked at venues. Later, he talked his way into Paris Fashion Week, claiming to be Giorgio Peviani, the man behind the knockoff jeans. The jeans exist. The man does not. Never mind. He was wined and dined. Then there was his completely fake restaurant, The Shed at Dulwich. By enlisting his friends to make comments on TripAdvisor, he managed to get the garden shed he rented to live in to be the number one rated restaurant in London, his burner phone ringing off the hook. And when people would call to book, he'd say, "Sorry, we're full up." Then, just to see how far he could push his luck, he turned it for one night into an actual restaurant with a friend playing a pretentious waitress to perfection. Let's listen.
So we've got a beautiful vegetable lasagna for you, and the chef has foraged these delights on the top as well. It's just a beautiful little garnish.
Has foraged the what from the chocolate bars? Just a listen, we'll find out. The video, How to Become TripAdvisor's Number One Fake Restaurant, was seen almost 40 million times on Facebook. Uba Butler hit the media, became a motivational speaker, does not live in the shed anymore, and now he's published a very thin little book about how he did this. And maybe that's the point, because the title says it all. How to BS your way to number one. Uba Butler, we cannot say that word, even though our president does. So we ask that we go with BS, and welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
It is a very thin little book, but there's a nugget in there about how, as a little kid, you wanted to get something at the dime store or something, and your parents said no. And you went and what, sold seashells?
Yeah, that's right. I took to the beach and collected everything I could, sold them to passers-by, and raised enough to go and get myself the toy. So I had the last laugh in that situation.
And so a scam artist was born, because here you are selling shells to people who are steps from shells. How would you characterize yourself? I said scam artist. How would you characterize what you do?
I think I was entertaining people. I've always liked entertaining people. And I've grown up a little bit now. I've written this book about this kind of method of kind of using, not being overly invested in what you do and using that to achieve in life. And I guess that it changes all the time, right? The way that we identify ourselves. And I would say I was, what I look back at that, and I think I was trying to entertain people and myself, definitely.
Well, but you wanted to pull the wool over people's eyes. You go as Giorgio Peviani to this fashion show. And, maybe some people would say, well, shame on them for being so easily fooled by this guy in these cut-off shorts. You cut the jeans down and put sunglasses on. But others might say, when it gets to the restaurant part, there are people who genuinely thought that, wow, there's this great restaurant I want to go see. What was your thinking here? Was it about really getting at TripAdvisor, which I think you worked around TripAdvisor at one point? Was it getting at that kind of pop-up restaurant scene where people have to go to the latest, greatest thing? Like, what were you trying to get at?
I guess that, I mean, I could have definitely been one of those people eating at the shed. I think we are all those people who want to eat at the shed. The reason they wanted to eat there was because they were told that they couldn't eat there. And I think there's something really human about that. I don't think it's particular about these particular set of people are stupid, or that wasn't what I was trying to say. And then TripAdvisor, you know, I'd, in a previous sort of life, I'd worked in restaurants and behind bars. And when people left one-star reviews, you know, the whole staff would be, you'd get it in the neck. So when I started writing, and I started writing fake reviews for restaurants for money on TripAdvisor as like a younger man,
right,
it was kind of fascinating to me to see that this reality that a lot of people take extremely seriously was perhaps false. And I thought that that was worth exploring.
Could be so gamed. I mean, you were gaming the system, as you say, when you were writing false, when you were hired to write false reviews for real restaurants.
Yeah.
And then you start writing false reviews, or having your friends write false reviews for a restaurant that doesn't even exist. And as you say, there's supposed to be this anti-doping algorithm on TripAdvisor that nobody could get around. So I'm imagining that was part of the challenge originally. Can I get around it? And you did.
Yeah. I mean, the opportunities that we got through that, you know, I had PR companies wanting to represent me for reduced rates. Companies who make in-flight videos to advertise London wanted to come and film there. There was hundreds and hundreds of minor celebrities, influencers, people wanted to eat there. And, you know, it was a complete fiction.
Well, here's what people were viewing on your fake website, with which you set up with your photographer friend Chris. There were some food pictures. One was a dishwasher detergent tablet covered in honey. Another, a blob of foam shaving cream scattered with pepper. And this is what you were presenting as the food of the successful restaurant. What were you thinking as it started to rise, as it you started to see, hey, we're the number 500 restaurant, hey, we're number 300 restaurant, hey, we're in the top 100. Oh, my God, I'm number one. And you don't even have a restaurant.
Exactly. And it all come from that complete non-investment in the whole thing. Like, I was just trying to enjoy every step of the process, which I did greatly. One of the food photos is actually, it's a ham hock, it's advertised as, and looks delicious. But if you uncrop the image, it's actually an egg on my foot. And it was kind of an accurate way of summing it up. And every step of the way, you know, I'm not a good cook, but I was able, because I was completely creatively freed by not being so overly invested in it, I was able to make this restaurant a success. And I'd never made anything a success before.
Well, and in the book, pamphlet, really, you're passing on what you learned to other people about, you know, metaphorically figure out the shed that you're in and how do you get out of it and have a toolbox. Again, we're staying with the shed analogy of tools that can help you achieve this kind of an idea. But then let go of the idea. As you said, figure out ways to game things, like make something a game if you've got a goal. But ultimately, just let go of it, not care about it.
Yeah, I think what it is it's kind of trying to help. Yeah, okay, so for example, with this book, I would love to become a number one bestseller. But the thing is that it's not stressful for me, that pursuit. It would have in the past been very inhibiting, but it's not stressful for me because I'm here, like, I'm speaking to you right now, and that's all. The book is already a success because of that. Like, I love this show. And, like, if I don't become number one, then it doesn't matter. Like, but if I do, then whoever reads this book can apply it to whatever they want.
Well, two things, Uba. Number one, oh, my God, if I help you get to number one, I don't know what I'm going to do to myself. I mean, with all the authors that I know would die to get to number one and refer back to your slim pamphlet. But you also say that while you let go of really caring too much at a certain point, do not listen to the doubters at all. Now that you're super successful, you know, living the high life, you also say don't listen to the people telling you how successful you are.
Yeah. I guess what I'm trying to do is this is less about kind of helping people to achieve success and more about helping them to sort of not be inhibited. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And just coming to the length of the book pamphlet, the thing is with the book is I wanted to, it's very deliberate, like I wanted, my audience is extremely young and you can barely get people to watch a 30-second video, so, let alone read a full book. So I was just trying to create something that was reactive and felt kind of appropriate to release. I hope that people could, I really would like people to be able to read this in like a day. Like, I don't think it's beyond anybody to do that.
Well, see, but now we don't trust you, Uba Butler, because now we don't know if you sat down and said, I got a great idea. I'm going to put together a little thing about how I did this, and then I'll be a number one bestseller, just like I was the number one restaurant. We don't know. Do you have people saying that to you? I don't know if I can trust you.
Yeah, and I guess that it's just like, I would just have to go back to just say, like, I was younger then and I was reacting to the situation. I've grown up a little now. I was more focused on entertaining people before, and now it's like, can I try and help people? Can I do that? And apparently I've been inadvertently practicing like a Buddhist kind of way of thinking about things. And I don't know. Like, I think that there's value in that. And I wouldn't be sharing it unless I thought that. However, I can sympathise because I did go at Christmas dinner last year. My great auntie said, please don't send a fake version of yourself. So if people that close to me are not trusting me, then I don't begrudge you for doing the same.
You mentioned Buddhism, but actually I wondered if this was a joke or not. In your acknowledgements, you credit a form of witchcraft.
Yeah, Obeah witchcraft.
You really believe that?
Well, I think that it's sort of an in-joke between me and my family, because my name is very close to it.
Why? Give us one aspect of this witchcraft that you say has shaped every major decision you've ever made.
I think that the thing is with it is it's just that I'm considered to be extremely lucky and play by my own rules. And that is aligned somewhat with the values of Obeah, I'm told.
Uba Butler. Again, the book is How to BS Your Way to Number One. Uba, you are delightful.
Oh, could I just thank my publisher, Ware Publications? There was plenty of opportunities to get in bed with bigger publishers, but they've been amazing. They're a small Brooklyn art press and all of them.
Uba, thank you so much.
That was an absolute delight. Thank you so much. This is a dream of mine.
Oh, you say that to all the interviewers.
No, I don't.
And the restaurant patrons.
Yeah. No, I don't. I genuinely listen to NPR every day. So this is really a delight. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, maybe. By the way, Obeah Witchcraft is born in the Caribbean. It's also called Science and Spirituality. I think Uba's serious about Obeah. But again, he sold mac and cheese at Haute Cuisine.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, the revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. Ember Wave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018, learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Ember Wave. Control your comfort.
We're learning more about that militia group based along the U.S.-Mexico border after a member, Larry Hopkins, appeared in a New Mexico courtroom yesterday on gun charges. Documents unsealed in court showed that the FBI was watching Hopkins in 2017 after witnesses said he talked about the group, the United Constitutional Patriots, training to assassinate Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and George Soros. Hopkins' lawyer disputes this. Let's bring in Angela Cocherga, who covers the border for the Albuquerque Journal. Angela, you've read through this unsealed criminal complaint. What more does it say?
Well, it's very interesting. The weapons and ammunition charges that Hopkins faces actually stem from a different part of New Mexico, not here on the border where I'm located, where this is all playing out. It was actually in the fall of 2017 that the FBI went into his residence in Flora Vista, New Mexico, and found multiple weapons and had been watching him and had learned through witnesses that this group, the United Constitutional Patriots, that he claimed to be the leader of, were training. His home was the base for to assassinate George Soros, Hillary Clinton, and Barack Obama, because they believe that these, as quoting now the complaint, these individuals supported Antifa.
Antifa, of course, this group of left-wing activists who have clashed with right-wing groups in recent times. But did anybody witness them actually doing that training?
It's unclear. The witnesses saw multiple weapons, and it was confirmed when they entered the residence. And by that time, Hopkins had already had three convictions and was not, as a felon, allowed to possess weapons or ammunition. In the complaint, it says he claimed these belonged to his common-law wife, He also had tactical, bulletproof vests. So it's unclear. And it also does say there were about 20 people that had been observed going to this trailer park in this remote area of New Mexico to train and, I guess, plot these alleged activities.
And to remind people, this all came to light because video surfaced of members of the group rounding up and holding and detaining asylum seekers, families, people with children at gunpoint. And so this arrest was because Larry Hopkins, as you said, was not supposed to have guns. He was a felon. But the question is, what happened with those complaints that he and the group were training to assassinate, at that point, a former president? How is it that you can be walking around on the border then detaining migrants? I mean, can you fill in that gap?
We don't know why it took so long. And of course, the group is, and the lawyer for Larry Hopkins is alleging these charges were kind of just pulled out of thin air to get him off the border. The lawyer for Hopkins also says his client did not have weapons here on the border, that he was merely there at the camp. Now, Hopkins identified himself to me when I interviewed him a while back as the commander of the group and talked about they needed weapons to protect themselves from drug smugglers and human smugglers. But yesterday I talked to the spokesman for these United Constitutional Patriots, and he told me, no, he was simply a cook at the camp. So there's a big dispute over that. Mm-hmm. But it is not clear why these very serious allegations and in this complaint detailed here were not, followed up on, because Hopkins was out on the border and has been for several months leading this group or cooking for them. We're not clear, depending upon your version of what was going on.
That's Angela Kucherga, a border reporter for the Albuquerque Journal. And Angela, I have a feeling we'll be talking to you again as this story unfolds. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob.
A competition known as the Olympics of Hula is underway in Hilo, Hawaii this week. The Merry Monarch Festival brings in competitors from around the world, people from different halaus, or schools, to dance to meles, or songs. They're led by kumuhula, or leaders. One of them is Keanu Kaupu, whose halau is performing in the festival this year and has been a top finisher in the past. He joins us from Hawaii Public Radio in Honolulu. Keanu, aloha. Welcome to Here and Now.
Aloha from Hawaii. Mahalo nui for having me.
It is great to have you. And the Merry Monarch Festival was named by the last of Hawaii's kings in the 1870s, King Kalakaua, who is credited with restoring hula's place in Hawaiian society. He called hula the language of the heart and the heartbeat of the Hawaiian people. Tell me, what is hula's place right now in Hawaiian society?
Hula has changed a lot. But it has and still is the heartbeat of the Hawaiian people. It touches upon every aspect of Hawaiian culture. Hula is thriving at this moment. It has had another resurgence, not only in the times of Kalakaua, but from the 1960s and the 1970s, where culture and Hawaiian language was starting to become a little bit more prevalent. And Merry Monarch is a very good benchmark, I guess you could say. It is proof that hula is thriving.
And you've been a competitor in this competition before. What is it like to perform at the Merry Monarch?
Well, I've been in many different roles at the Merry Monarch since 1990. So I've started off as a spectator. I'm from Hilo, so it's just a kind of the fabric that makes up Hilo. It's part of that fabric that makes up the small, sleepy town of Hilo on the island of Hawaii. And then I became a dancer. Since 1990, I've done costumes and leis and hair and chanted and sang. And now I'm taking my own halau along with my fellow kumuhula, Lono Padilla. We have our own halau, halau hi'i akai namakalehua, and we're taking them to compete. You know, in the whole scope of things, we're a very young halau. We're the baby kumuhula, amongst some other baby kumuhulas, and then amongst some of the elder kumuhulas as well. who have been in this competition for 30, 40 years. So we're very honored and we're very proud to be able to take this journey with them.
And you have to actually be invited to this competition, right?
Yes, yes. And the waiting list is pretty long. Mm-hmm. We waited a few years. We just celebrated our 10-year anniversary. You know, it's kind of not usual that newer halals just all of a sudden in 5 years they're entering Mary Monarch. Many people wait 10, 15 years just to get in.
Well, we've been listening to one of your favorite hula songs, Kaena, by the brothers Casimero. Why is this one a favorite of yours, and what do you do when it comes to the dance to this particular song?
You can hear their voices, strong, gentle. It really tells the story of what, or tells the mo'olelo of what the song really talks about, and it talks about love. It talks about how love is like sea spray, and how it, when you're deep in it, it's like being drenched by the sea spray of Kaena, which is the most westernmost point on the island of Oahu. We had a chance to travel to Kaena, and it's kind of a rough travel and a rough hike, but once we got there, it was just serene and beautiful. So a lot of emotions go into this mele, and a lot of what we call eha, pain, and not just pain and agony, but pain of love, that when you're so in love and you're so deep in love that it hurts, even if it's good, it hurts. There's eha.
What is the difference between a man's role and a woman's role in hula?
Some you can't really tell a very big difference. For us, in our halal, there's a huge difference. Our boys, we try to teach them to be strong, masculine, as well as graceful. And what men often think is that grace only belongs to women or is a feminine characteristic. Not so. Not so. If men didn't have grace, we'd really look awkward. Mm-hmm. The women really emphasize their hips. They really emphasize the grace in their hands and the wave in their hands. Our men, we don't wave too much.
Ask you about an instrument that we hear in some hula. This is another one of your favorite songs. It's called Mohala Ka Hinano. This is composed and recorded by Johnny Lum Ho. And in the background in this, you hear the ukulele, which is an instrument that Portuguese immigrants brought to Hawaii in the 19th century. How did that change hula?
Well, it opened up a whole new world, I think, hearing different types of keys and melodies. That came along with Christianity and hymn music. And we actually have mele, or songs, about the, actually chants, about the first time people hear the sound of a piano or the sound of an ukulele. And it's really interesting because now we don't think of it as such a big thing. A piano is a piano. Mm-hmm. But back in the 1800s...
It was quite a change.
It was quite a change. Mm-hmm. Things that are introduced, like the mirror. No, Hawaiians never saw a mirror before. And so mele were written about that. So it's not surprising that ukulele came about and just kind of exploded. And now everybody's, you know, around the world is learning how to play ukulele.
So let's just go back finally to the Merry Monarch Festival that okay. you'll be competing in. I just want to ask you, like, how does it make you feel to hula, especially when you're doing it in competition?
You know, that's an easy question and yet such a hard question. How does it make me feel? Well, it touches on every part of my senses. Not just because we need to see and we need to touch and other people can see our movements, but it's really hard to dance hula if you don't feel. It just makes you feel. For me, my all senses start to work. All senses are activated. I am able to release emotions that maybe my everyday life doesn't allow me to at the moment. Once I'm dancing or I'm chanting, I'm in another world. A lot of times I don't remember a performance if my Waialua, my spirit, is dancing. One of the hardest things is to actually capture that feeling, to actually take your audience with you into your mele, take them back to time, take them back to those experiences that your song is talking about.
That is Keanu Kaupu joining us from Honolulu. Keanu, thank you so much. Mahalo and aloha. Good luck in the festival.
Thank you very much. Mahalo nui for having me.
In Tehran today, the Iranian parliament voted overwhelmingly to label all American military forces terrorists. Last week, they voted to label any U.S. forces in the Middle East terrorists. Today's vote expanded that. And it follows the Trump administration designating Iran's Revolutionary Guard a terrorist organization. Also yesterday, the White House said that now no country will be exempt from sanctions if they buy oil from Iran. President Trump reimposed those sanctions when he pulled the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal last year, but he gave some waivers. Now he's rescinded them. Barbara Slavin is director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. And Barbara, we're thinking, we spoke to you when those sanctions were reimposed. How would you characterize this ratcheting up?
Well, fortunately, at least on the Iranian side, it's primarily rhetorical and political at this point. I think the real concern is that Iran, deprived of oil revenues, despite the fact that it is complying with the nuclear agreement, might actually pull out of that agreement and start accelerating its nuclear program again.
I want you to say that again, because for those, you know, trying to, we need whiteboards at this point to follow this. And the president pulled out of the nuclear agreement and imposed sanctions, even though every observer agreed that Iran was abiding by the agreement.
The logic behind the administration move, frankly, still mystifies me, because had the United States remained within the agreement, it could have tried to negotiate with Iran and with other countries on other issues that are of concern to the United States. Instead, by withdrawing from the agreement, reimposing sanctions, what the U.S. has done is created a great deal of enmity with many of our allies. There are obviously a few countries, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Israel, that have cheered on this move. But the Europeans, Russians, Chinese, others are very angry about it. So a year later, the U.S. policy is showing no signs of success. So what do? They double down and now insist that no oil can be exported by Iran to the rest of the world. This is what is known as secondary sanctions. These are illegal under international economic rules, and the U.S. is only able to impose them because of the strength of the dollar, the importance of the dollar in the international financial system. So I'm waiting to see how the rest of the world reacts. Will they still import Iranian oil, and what do we do then?
Which countries do you think might do that? Explain to us who these players are.
There are some countries that need the United States so much that they don't dare do it. Japan, South Korea.
Well, we understand that India said today they will not buy oil from Iran. Mm.
China and Turkey, I think, have both been very open about the fact that they intend to continue to buy oil. India may stop for a while, but, you know, a lot of people around the world, not just in the United States, are looking toward our 2020 elections. If President Trump is defeated, many of them hope they can return to normal business with Iran, since this is really a policy of the Trump administration that has been rejected by, indeed, most of the Democrats who are running to replace President Trump.
Yeah. And what does it mean? You know, just give us more context for this. So let's say India doesn't, huge country. China and maybe one other country, you know, do continue to buy the oil despite the sanctions. What is that? How does that ripple out? What does that do to U.S.-China relations? They're in the middle of trade talks.
It adds more complications to our trade talks with China. It adds more complications to our already very troubled relationship with Turkey. But let's talk about American consumers. You know, price of oil is going up. Price of gasoline is going up. You can't reduce Iranian oil exports and expect U.S. oil prices or gasoline prices to stay low, which is another goal of the Trump administration. Remember that Venezuela, which produces a similar sort of heavy crude to Iran, is also having difficulties now. It's under U.S. sanctions as well. U.S. is trying to change the regime in Venezuela. So prices will go up for consumers. It will have an impact on everyone's economy. It will indirectly help the Iranians because whatever they can sell for more.
Barbara, just why do you think this is happening now? The Trump administration says that Iran is, you know, backing terrorist groups. Hezbollah is a group based in Lebanon. Has there been, you know, a flare-up of terrorism? I mean, why these moves now?
Well, I think it's frustration on the part of the Trump administration that Iran has remained within the deal. You know, if Iran pulls out, then the United Nations, European Union will put back sanctions that they had lifted under the nuclear deal. Then the United States would not be alone in its coercive techniques. So I think they're really trying to goad the Iranians into pulling out of the deal, committing a major act of terrorism, which thank God the Iranians have not done. I'm worried about possible, as the military calls them, second and third order effects in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. So there are a lot of ways in which Iran can push back against these unilateral U.S. actions.
Barbara Slavin, director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. Barbara, thank you. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.